It's Essential Pittsburgh. I'm Paul Guggenheimer. One of Pittsburgh's greatest strengths is its hospitals, attracting top professionals from around the globe with state-of-the-art facilities. In addition, there is the opportunity to obtain research assistance from two world-class universities. One doctor drawn to Pittsburgh is our guest, pediatric cardiologist Dr. Bernard Kuhn. He is studying heart regeneration in the hope that it could treat heart failure in children. Dr. Kuhn, welcome to Essential Pittsburgh.
Hi, how are you?
Good, sir. First off, what led you to pursue a career in pediatrics?
Well, I came to pediatrics really more or less serendipitously. I was on a track for basic science to become a pharmacologist, and then in the last year of medical school, I had a stipend to spend, a scholarship to spend in the United States, and I had to choose what subjects to study. And I thought, well, you know, pediatrics might be good. You might have children at some point, and it might be good to have a little bit more in-depth knowledge of that. And then I started to really like it, and in the course of that scholarship time here in the United States, I met some and saw working physician scientists who were real career models. And I thought, well, these are great opportunities. This is really what you really want to do. Let's try it out. And so I'm still here since 1999.
And folks listening to this might have detected a bit of an accent. You are originally from, you're a native of Germany, and you're from a part of Germany that was once behind the Iron Curtain, what used to be known as East Germany. And you, fortunately, were growing up at a time when that curtain, that Berlin Wall was coming down, and there was no longer the division in the country that had existed. What sorts of opportunities did that create for you?
Well, as in most communist societies, then your career path was set very early on and did not include a lot of your desires or aspirations. And so when the wall came down, I did civil service, which is public service in nursing homes and hospitals. And that really raised my interest in a career in medicine. And I was able to do that and apply to a Western German, or then Unified Germany, medical school in Berlin, and then we spent a great time in Berlin for 8 years seeing how the two countries came together.
You were originally based in Boston. Why did you decide to move your operation to Pittsburgh?
Well, I did my advanced clinical training and my advanced research training as well in Boston, and I stayed on as faculty. And Boston is a great place for starting careers, and I felt I was ready for the next big step. And maybe the one of the questions that you could epitomize is that I was asking myself, do I want to be defined by my environment, or do I want to define my environment? And so far, the past 9 months in Pittsburgh, that was really great. And I feel that these aspirations really start to bear fruit. Besides Pittsburgh being a great place for my family, they are very happy here. Our three kids love their schools. We love our neighbors, very nice people. And Children's Hospital of Pittsburgh, by volume of operation, is one of the major freestanding children's hospitals in this country. And this really, compared with the environment at Harvard, we have everything here, plus more freedom of operation.
Tell us about the challenges in treating heart failure in children compared to adults.
There's multiple challenges, and they're increasingly well recognized. And one is that in pediatrics, patients grow, so the heart grows. In adults, homeostasis is reached, that is, you're at an adult size. And that brings me then to the notion that comes from the fact that heart failure therapies that are established mainstays in adult heart failure therapy, for example, beta blockers, for example, angiotensin-converting enzyme inhibitors, and many adult heart failure patients take them. These medicines are now proven to not work in children. There is highly rigorous clinical trials that show that beta blockers and other drugs don't work in children. And that then led in our field of pediatric cardiology to the notion that we must come up with a strategy to make, if you wish, our own therapies for our patients, and we must stop importing from, exclusively importing from adults. There's a lot of good development, clearly, that came from adults to children. For a great example, for example, is mechanical circulatory support with mechanical pumps. That was spearheaded here in Pittsburgh and works very well. However, in the medical realm, I think we, in the biological realm, we must understand, we have to do research to understand the unique mechanisms that are active in pediatric hearts, and growth and cellular growth and proliferation is one of those unique aspects that's present in infants but not in adult patients. And if and when we understand these mechanisms, that may provide us with a keyhole for new therapies.
You and your staff have made some important discoveries over the past few years. What can you tell us about them and how they will impact the future of pediatrics?
Well, one discovery that we've made is that an endogenous growth factor called neuregulin can be used to stimulate proliferation of heart muscle cells, and that is the basic mechanism of regeneration. My vision and hope is that neuregulin one day may become something like insulin for heart failure. Neuregulin is currently in phase 2 trials in adult patients, and we want to understand better how it could potentially work in our pediatric patients, specifically what patient populations within pediatric or cardiac patients might be most responsive, and that is, might show the greatest benefit.
And tell us about the research that you're currently working on.
So probably 50%, if not more, of our team is working on basic science questions, trying to understand the basic molecular and cellular mechanisms of heart muscle cell proliferation and differentiation. And we are there focusing on the postnatal development, that is, development that happens after birth. And another part of the team works on applying this understanding in humans. So we are developing methods so that we can study heart muscle proliferation and differentiation in our human patients. And we do this in close collaboration with our full-time clinical colleagues, and take frequent trips to the operating rooms and obtain material from there and study it in the lab.
In a recent news article, Anita Marcello, president of the Children's Heart Research Guild, said, and I quote, "If you can keep your kids alive for the next 5 years, so much will be changed. There's going to be so much more." Are you anticipating any major breakthroughs regarding children's heart research in the near future?
Well, I couldn't agree more with the statement of our president. In terms of specific heart research, I think that pediatric cardiology and pediatric cardiac surgery really is one of the poster child examples of success in pediatrics. And this is over the past 50 or 60 years, when we as a field have achieved to convert a formerly severe and lethal type of diseases into a survivable condition. What we now must focus on is the quality and the duration of life of our survivors. And that is a high bar to make. But we're committed, and we're in the right environment, and we have the right support to achieve that.
It's Essential Pittsburgh. I'm Paul Guggenheimer, and my guest is pediatric cardiologist Dr. Bernard Kuhn. He is studying heart regeneration in the hope that it could treat heart failure in children. It's Essential Pittsburgh. I'm Paul Guggenheimer. An estimated 1 in 5 children will experience the death of someone close to them by age 18, and over 1 million children in the United States are living in single-parent homes due to the death of a parent. Losing your mother, father, or loved one is hard at any age, but it can be even harder for adolescents. An organization called Circle Camps for Grieving Children has emerged and is working to provide a safe, caring environment for young girls in our region who have experienced the death of a parent. I'm joined now in studio by Sandy Landau Welch, who is founder of Circle Camps for Grieving Children. Sandy Landau Welch, welcome to Essential Pittsburgh.
Thank you.
How do the camps work and where do they operate?
Our pilot program is in Sweden, Maine. It began 14 years ago. We have another program in Fitzwilliam, New Hampshire. And our newest program, Circle of EKC, is in Morgantown, West Virginia. This is the second year we'll be serving local girls.
And why would you say this was seen as a necessary service for young girls?
Grieving girls often feel isolated. They are different. To be the only young girl in your class who doesn't have a mom or a dad automatically sets you aside. In addition to feeling different at home,
why is it different for girls?
What happens when a young girl loses a parent, she often becomes a parent to the surviving parent or to brothers and sisters. So she's lived in a stable household and suddenly one parent dies, she has to cook, she has to clean, she has to get her brothers and sisters ready for school. Our research indicates that it is different for young girls.
But why would this be true for just girls? What about boys? Aren't they put in positions of responsibility when a parent dies or asked to do things that would, you know, responsibilities that would normally fall to an adult?
They are, and that is why we work very closely with another program that has camps just for young boys who have experienced the death of a parent. Their programs are in Maine, California, and upstate New York.
If not addressed, what kinds of traumas are young people carrying with them into adulthood?
A sense of isolation, a lack of self-esteem. Young girls often pull in. They stop going to after-school activities. As they pull in, their friends pull away. As their friends stop speaking with them, they no longer feel they have an outlet to express their grief. They don't feel like they can talk to the surviving parent, who is often so overwhelmed by just home and family circumstances. It's an outlet that is rarely tapped, and it's, for me, I would feel like it would be something that just grows inside of me and never gets released.
Did you have some sort of clinical background, or was there something that occurred over time, or maybe an epiphany that you had that said, I've got to start doing this? There's a need that's not being addressed.
It wasn't quite like that, but I'm 5'7". I was 5'7" when I was in third grade, and I was different. My parents sent me to overnight camp. There's something special about overnight camp. It's a different environment. It's safe. It enables you to be a different person at camp than you are at home. I went to summer camp for 12 years. When I left, I always wanted to do something at my camp for young girls who I thought couldn't afford to go there. The owner of the camp is a friend of mine. The day after the World Trade Towers were bombed, I was speaking to her. She said, I don't want to talk today. Two of my campers lost their mothers yesterday. And it was an epiphany. It was like the comic strip, the light bulb. I hung up the phone. I said, I'm going to do a camp for grieving girls. It just steamrolled from there.
What is the goal of a circle camp experience for a child?
To let them know that they are not alone, to give them an outlet for sharing their experiences, and perhaps most important is to teach a young girl that it is okay to laugh during the day, even though she may climb into bed and cry under the covers at night. I think that often children feel guilty when a parent dies and they go to school and they have fun in the schoolyard, and suddenly everybody is looking at them, and the young girl who experienced the death is thinking, wow, maybe I shouldn't be laughing. They all know I lost my mom. They come to camp, and our main camp say there'll be 124 other young girls who have experienced the same thing. If you were to visit camp, you would never know it was a camp for grieving children. We weave activities throughout the week that address their grief. But what we're telling them is you can be sad and you can also have fun.
Can you give me an example of something that some type of activity that specifically addresses the grief of a young person who has lost a parent?
One of the most powerful activities we do at every camp is called Circle Time. And the first day of camp, the girls sit by bunk on a porch in their cabins and they bring a picture of their parent who died. Led by a social worker, we go around the circle and each child can or may not choose to tell her story. And you sit in these circles. The first thing we do is we put a box of Kleenex in the middle of the circle, which is saying to everybody, it's okay to cry. Most of the girls do choose to speak. At the end of the period, the bell rings, and they cannot leave the cabin quickly enough to get to tubing or soccer or softball, whatever comes next. Sometimes the counselors are sitting there a little blown away, but the kids sort of pass on something, they share their stories, and then they go off to an activity.
I want to go back to something you said earlier about children, particularly girls, who lose a parent and it affects their self-esteem. Why would that affect their self-esteem? Why would something that the child has no control over affect how they think of themselves?
I think a psychologist or a psychiatrist could probably answer that better than I do. But being different as a kid or as a child, it's traumatic. I had no self-esteem when I was 9 years old. I was the biggest kid in the school. I did anything I could do to hide my height. I needed to find a place that told me it was okay to be the way I was. And that's what summer camp was for me. And to this day, I tell my mom, my dad's no longer living, it was the best gift they ever gave to me.
It's Essential Pittsburgh. I'm Paul Guggenheimer, and my guest is Sandy Lando Welch. She is the founder of an organization called Circle Camps for Grieving Children. Sandy, is it difficult to serve the needs of every child whose situation and the circumstance of their loss is unique to his or her, in this case, her own life?
No, we find that grief is sort of the great leveler. It doesn't seem to matter at camp whether the child lost a parent by suicide or by long illness or by violent means. To young girls, it's simply a major loss.
What are the common themes that these camps use to unite girls into a communal healing experience?
Well, it starts with a bunk experience. There will be anywhere from 7 to 9 girls in a bunk and 3 counselors. The counselors are a mix in age from 17, our youngest counselors, who were our former campers, to in their mid-70s. And it sounds hokey every time I say it, but we create a family. The bunk sleeps together. They eat together. They pretend to clean up the bunk together. They pretend to do rest hour. The bunks then come to the dining room where all 225 of us in Maine and where all 100 of us in West Virginia will eat together. We split up by bunks during the day, but at night we come together for our evening activity. We do it as a group. So we're a family. We consider ourselves a family. Also, the fact that young girls can start with us at age 9 and continue to come to camp as late as age 18, that's something that helps us build a larger community that stays with the girls.
People can say, like, oh, I know how you're feeling, or I'm sorry, but they don't really know how to react. Here, girls can put their own input in, and they can say, like, oh, me too, because everyone kind of has shared the same experience. Of course, the deaths are different and everyone has their own story, but everyone has experienced a loss in their family, and it's something big. Like, you may not think that you're that different from the next girl back at home, but it's something serious, and being able to express yourself here really helps.
I find it really nice to be able to share, because often when I'm at home, people find it awkward to talk about it. So during circle time, I can say anything I want about my dad, and I feel like everybody listens and nobody thinks it's strange.
How is it that you have come to identify, as you have, with these grieving girls when your experience growing up was different. I know you mentioned feeling like somewhat of an outcast because of your height, but you did not lose a parent as a child. So how is it that you're able to identify with them? And are there things that you have to do to make sure that you're really understanding what they're going through?
I think after 14 years, my understanding is better than it was. My best friend growing up was my cousin, and we came home from school one day, and her mother's bed was made. Her mom had died. Her father said to her, "There's no need for you to go to the funeral." And I never saw my cousin again. So
why?
Her dad removed her from anyone in the family that had a complete family. Maybe that was the impetus. I don't know. I just know that summer camp was such a magical experience for me in helping me become the person I am today. I've always known that there's a way to use it for things other than typical for-profit summer camping.
We tend to think of children as open and expressive to begin with. Not all of them are, but children generally tend to be a little less inhibited than adults, depending on the age. What is it about losing a loved one that causes a child to lose that expressiveness? And how can this process of going to a summer camp and having this experience reverse that?
Well, I think there's a little fear when you're alone. When everything that you knew and counted on changes at home, your outlook on life is changed. And I think you become afraid. We find when our newest campers or our first-year campers get off the bus, their eyes are wide and they're scared. They're hugging a stuffed animal. By being with others who have been through this, again, I will go back to, I think they realize they're not alone and they're not different, and they have somebody once they get home they can contact. It's a different community. It's an embracing community. It's safe. It's secure.
And you don't turn anybody away from this?
Well, we don't turn anybody away because most of the campers who come to us have been referred by a social service agency or by a personal psychologist or psychiatrist. But let me try this example. We had a camper for 6 years who never spoke in her circle time. She sat
six
there
6 years.
6 years. She sat there with her picture and did not speak, which is okay. The seventh summer at camp, she said to the social worker leading her circle, "I want to go first." So it took her 6 years to somehow feel comfortable enough in her own skin to share her story. She's a counselor with us now.
Why do you suppose that was?
I don't know. I mean, I don't know what was the valve that finally released within her. All I know is that we considered her one of our really fine success stories. She's a leader at camp now.
What can society do to better help children understand and grow and go through traumatic experiences?
I know that when a friend of mine died, maybe 8 or 9 months later, somebody said to me, "How are you?" I said, I have bad days. I'm still thinking about my friend. And the response was, "Are you kidding? After 8 months?" The implication was, get over it. Get on with life. I think there's a part of grieving that never leaves someone, especially when you're grieving for a parent. You just find a different place to tuck it inside of you. You put it away where you can bring it out when you feel like it. And I think that many people don't understand how long the death of a loved one stays with someone.
My dad died of a heart attack when I was 5. And I've been coming here for 2 years. And what I love about being here is that it's a lot of fun, but you also get to talk about serious things like that your parents have died, and you get to meet lots of friends, and they're really nice.
Some people have very supportive parents, some people don't, and they come here and this is their support group to know how's school going, how's this going. Even though they've lost someone, they get to do something special, and something special they get out of this negative aspect that's happened in their life.
Let's say you have a child who really can't stop crying, really can't stop feeling sad. and is reluctant to get involved with the others, you know, is really struggling. What do you do to deal with that?
You have to believe me when I say that's never happened. In 13 years of camp, we've never lost a camper to homesickness or to an inability to mix in. If you would come to camp by lunch, the kids arrive around 10:30. If you came to camp and saw the singing after lunch that first day at 12:30, you would think that these campers had been together for 3 or 4 or 5 days. There's something about the fact that campers return year after year, that counselors return year after year, that helps us at each camp create a close-knit community that embraces new campers, scared campers, tearful campers in such a way that it enables them to become part of the group.
Kids are kids, and I don't doubt that eventually they all come around, but you mentioned in particular this one girl who didn't talk for 6 years. When you're dealing with a kid who's reluctant to kind of jump in or participate or open up or whatever it is, what is then done?
For grief activities, we don't force anybody to participate. For regular activities, the kids don't have a choice. Somebody from each camp will meet each family prior to the girls coming to camp, and we lay out what it's like there. It's a rigid structure. The bugle blows at 7:30. The girls are scheduled throughout the day until they go to sleep at 9 o'clock. They understand their expectations that they will participate in sports. Every once in a while, I've interviewed several campers this last year. If I sense a true reluctance on the part of the camper to even leave home, or if somebody says, I don't like to swim, I don't want to play basketball, I don't do sports, I don't enjoy arts and crafts, I will suggest to the surviving parent, this may not be the right place for your daughter.
They're all there because they want to be there, because they are trying to, they're interested in accepting the help to go through the grieving process in a more productive way, I guess, for lack of a better way of putting that.
The older girls see it that way, Paul. The younger girls see it. It's a week of fun. Our grief activities are tailored to each age group. So the 9-year-olds do something totally different than the 12-year-olds might do. But it is rare that I can't ever remember having a camper at camp who simply just didn't want to be there.
If someone listening to this was interested in trying to find out more about these camps, where would they go for information?
Our website, www.circlecamps.org, has information about all our programs. And what might be most interesting to Pittsburgh listeners is Circle of EKC, our newest camp in Morgantown, West Virginia, now in its second year.
And we'll have a link to that on our website at wesa.fm. Sandy, thank you so much for joining us. We appreciate it.
Thank you.
More Essential Pittsburgh coming up. This is 90.5 WESA. It's Essential Pittsburgh. I'm Paul Guggenheimer. Over a 48-hour span during this week in June of 1963, June 10th and June 11th, to be exact, President John F. Kennedy set the United States on important trajectories with regard to the issues of race at home and nuclear nonproliferation abroad. Our guest, author Andrew Cohen, has written a new book called 2 Days in June, John F. Kennedy and the 48 Hours That Made History, that discusses how President Kennedy launched these two initiatives dealing with Russia and race that are chillingly relevant to the challenges we face in 2015. You may have seen his op-ed on the topic in the Post-Gazette. He has covered the Washington political scene for the Toronto Globe and Mail and joins us now by phone from Ottawa. Andrew Cohen, welcome to Essential Pittsburgh.
Pleased to be here, Paul.
You can join the conversation by calling 412-246-2002. That's 412-246-2002. Our email address is ESSPGH at WESA.FM and on Twitter at ESSPGH. Again, the number is 412-246-2002. Andrew Cohen, I'll begin by asking how a Canadian developed such a keen interest in this topic.
Well, I am a Canadian, and proudly so, but I spent many years in the United States, and I went to school in the United States. As it happened, I went to the Choate School, which is the same school that John F. Kennedy went to, and I covered Washington, the White House, for several years. So it was not a big leap. You know, John F. Kennedy was not just president of the United States in those days. He was president, in a sense, of the free world, and anyone growing up in his shadow would have been aware of him and would have been shaped by him. Certainly I was.
Explain what happened with President Kennedy over this two-day time period of June 10th and June 11th, 1963.
Well, it's the spring of 1963, Paul, and John F. Kennedy has been president of the United States for 2.5 years. And it had been, I think it's safe to say, an uneven presidency, a fitful presidency of some successes and some failures. 1961 was a very difficult year for him. That was the year of the Bay of Pigs, which was a disaster for him in the United States. It was the year he was rather bullied in a meeting with Nikita Khrushchev in Vienna, and that was the year the wall goes up in Berlin. And at the end of that year, a journalist says to JFK he wants to write the story of his presidency, and JFK says, why would you want to write a story about disasters? By 62, things are better. That famously, we remember the Cuban Missile Crisis when Kennedy faced down Nikita Khrushchev, and those missiles were forced to be removed from Cuba, and he integrated the University of Mississippi. By 1963, John F. Kennedy, who had studied history, written history, and now wants to make history, is wondering just what he has to do to get ahead, in a sense, on the two big issues of his time, which are nuclear arms and civil rights. How does he gain the momentum, and rather than reacting to events, responds and begins to remake them, to counter to them. And so he has attempted through Nikita Khrushchev and a back channel, the Pope, to reimagine the relationship the United States in Cold War, lily white America. Remember, this was the Cold War. Kids were practicing duck and cover exercises in classes. The bomb shadowed life in, well, really everywhere, but particularly in America. And Kennedy realizes by the spring of 63 that he can make a new overture to Khrushchev. And on June the 10th, at 10:30 a.m., having flown back from Hawaii on a cross-continental trans-Pacific flight on Air Force One, where my book opens, he races up to American University and will give what will be called, Paul, in the future, the peace speech. It's a commencement address to the class of 1963 at American University in Washington, Northwest Washington. And there, he will talk about the Russians in a way no president has talked about the Russians since Franklin Roosevelt in 1945, when the Russians were America's ally. He will humanize the Russians. He'll celebrate their achievements in science and space. And the reason America's in space in 63 is because the Russians are. He'll talk about their sacrifices in the Second World War, 20 million Russian men and women killed and so much of their country devastated. And then he'll make an offer to suspend the testing of nuclear weapons, which both the Russians and the Americans were doing, so much so the atmosphere was being filled with radioactive material showing up in mother's milk. And he will say to Khrushchev, if you'll consider this, why don't we talk about limiting in a serious way the spread or proliferation of nuclear weapons? And Khrushchev hears the speech, is struck by Kennedy's tone, which is conciliatory. Remember, presidents didn't talk that way about the Russians then. His tone was nearly subversive, actually, in America in those days. Khrushchev hears it. He invites negotiators to Moscow. And from there, there will be the first of the arms control treaties of the Cold War. It'll be called the Limited Nuclear Test Ban Treaty. It will be John F. Kennedy's greatest achievement in foreign policy. At the same time this is happening, he's handling a crisis in Alabama where Governor Wallace, George Wallace in Alabama, the segregationist governor, has said he will stand at the door of the University of Alabama on June the 11th at 11 a.m. and prevent the admission of two black students, Vivian Malone and James Hood, who want to enter the university. The Kennedys know that Wallace will not be able to stop the power of the federal government, but they're worried about it going all wrong. They will face him down at the door. He will refuse at first to allow the admission of those two students. Kennedy will issue an executive order, call the National Guard, integrate the university, and at 5:30 that afternoon, he will say to Ted Sorensen, his extraordinary speechwriter, Ted, it's time we made that speech on civil rights tonight. And Ted Sorensen, who had done everything for John F. Kennedy for the last 11 years in what was the most successful partnership between a president and a speechwriter, will write a speech in which John F. Kennedy will go on the air at 8 p.m. that night, June the 11th, and he will talk about the Negroes, as they're then called then, black Americans, in a way that no president had talked about them since Lincoln in language worthy of Lincoln. He will, in that speech, call civil rights no longer a legal question, but a moral one. He'll talk about the fires of frustration burning in America tonight in cities north and south where no legal remedies are at hand. There's an eerie resonance about that today. And in that speech, the news in that speech is he will unveil what will be the Civil Rights Act of 1964. He won't live to see it. It will be like that pioneering treaty the day before, announced the day before, one of the great pieces of legislation of the 20th century. So 2 days, two speeches, two extraordinary issues in which John F. Kennedy pivots, and this is his crowded hour, and for me, this is his moment of heroism in the United States.
And, of course, these two speeches, these two monumental history-changing events would not have happened one after another had it not been for Kennedy initiating the reaching out with the olive branch to the Soviet Union in that speech at American University on June 10th. What was the epiphany, if you will, that Kennedy ended up having? Where did it come from, the impetus for this?
Well, it's a very good question, Paul. And I think it was not one moment in which he said, we have to change the world, but Cuba, the Cuban Missile Crisis, for those people with a memory of that, it happens to be my first political memory as a seven-year-old. Those who were around remember Cuba will recognize how close we came to blowing each other up. In fact, it was closer than we even knew at the time, because it was only revealed 30 years later, about 20 years ago, that Soviet battlefield commanders had control of tactical nuclear weapons, which they could have launched almost upon will had there been an American airstrike or an American invasion of Cuba, which was being seriously considered. So I think Kennedy and Nikita Khrushchev, who had this rather difficult relationship at first, realized they have to do something to lower the temperature. And that spring, through the Pope and the editor of the Saturday Review called Norman Cousins, they begin talking through a back channel. They open a correspondence, and they begin to say to each other, what would it take to take the first step? And the first step would be, let's stop testing nuclear weapons. We already have enough. Let us back away from that. And actually, Kennedy wanted a comprehensive ban. He wanted no testing on anything. So the treaty that was signed actually allowed testing underwater and in space, which never really happened, but it was underwater, and the testing was banned on land. So it did continue in a small way underground, just nobody really was able to know about it. But the epiphany was not so much an epiphany, but a gradual realization that if we don't do something, when John F. Kennedy goes to the podium at American University under a withering sun, it was 98 degrees in Washington, and he's wearing the heavy robes which a president wears when he's going to make a commencement speech before a graduating class, he feels and he says, this is the most important issue in the world. And he says to his brother, Bobby, I have two children. You've got eight, I think, at the time. It's not about us anymore. It's about them. Khrushchev feels the same thing. So the two of them, and when this is done and the treaty is signed, which Kennedy, of course, is ratified by the Senate, Kennedy begins to imagine with Khrushchev a whole institution of peace and what it might look like. And he wants to go to Moscow in 1964. At the UN in the fall of 63, about 2 months before he died, he says, why don't we collaborate in space with the Soviets so there will be no space race? He sees this as the beginning of a relationship. And Paula, was no longer for him about winning the Cold War. It was about ending it. And that was the critical thing. And that's why this speech, if you look back at today and listeners can watch it online, it is really today an extraordinary expression of conciliation toward the Soviet Union. And although John F. Kennedy knew all about the gulags and knew all about the nuclear stockpiles, he wasn't going to use that rhetoric in this speech. He was going to see or try and deal with the Soviets entirely differently, with a certain respect and a certain humanity and empathy, the kind of thing that some say we might try on Vladimir Putin in Ukraine.
And I have a question about that, but before I ask that, what was the reaction to Kennedy's speech as it, you know, went out on the news that night? I don't imagine it was broadcast live, but
well, actually, Paul, it was broadcast live, and that wasn't unusual for presidential speeches then. But the reaction was, the reaction was rather tepid. It wasn't terrible enthusiasm. There were in some quarters newspaper reaction, which I go through, was quite supportive and quite enthusiastic. One British paper, the Manchester Guardian, called it one of the great state papers in American history. But if you look at the White House mail, and of course people did in those days, at the end of that week, far more letters came in about a looming strike in a looming rail strike that would have shut down the nation's railways than this speech. Now, the next night, that was different. That did create a lot of reaction, and that speech was given entirely differently. John F. Kennedy went on the air on Tuesday, June the 11th, with no complete text. After 11 minutes, he's winging it. But both, I would say, in a presidency of rhetoric, I would say to you, Paul, both were his two greatest speeches. I think they were greater than the inaugural address or the speech he'll give in Berlin, which is a wonderful piece of theater, which would happen 2 weeks later in that month of June of 1963.
It's Essential Pittsburgh. I'm Paul Guggenheimer. My guest is Andrew Cohen, author of 2 Days in June, John F. Kennedy and the 48 Hours That Made History. Before I get more into what President Kennedy said on June 11th, what would Kennedy be doing today with regard to Russia? How would he handle Putin?
Well, Kennedy's the emblem of Kennedy's relationship with Khrushchev was respect. Kennedy never wanted to try and humiliate Khrushchev. After the Cuban Missile Crisis, which was largely seen as a defeat for Nikita Khrushchev because he was forced to withdraw those missiles, Kennedy told his staff and his circle of advisors, do not make any declarations of victory. Do not appear triumphalist. Do not rub his nose in it. Kennedy said his position is weaker than it was in the Kremlin. Do not make it any worse than it already is, and let's see if we can build on this to renew our relationship, which is what he does in the winter and the spring of 1963 after that terrible fall. I think today Kennedy would be saying Vladimir Putin may be no more likable to us in what he is doing than Nikita Khrushchev, who, by the way, had been threatening to move on Berlin, that island of democracy deep in East Germany, had been threatening for some time. The stakes were much higher, really, in 1963 in that nuclear world. I think Kennedy Day would be saying, I know all about who Putin is. I don't like that he's in Ukraine. But is there a way out? Could we give him, could we open a back channel? Could we use diplomacy? Could we attempt at the very moment he's cornered, particularly now with the Russian ruble having collapsed and the price of oil having fallen steeply, is there a way out, and Americans and Western sanctions biting, is there a way out for him? I think Kennedy would have always been looking beyond what the extremists were saying and the militants were saying. He wouldn't listen to the voices in Congress, I can tell you that. He would attempt to open a conversation with Putin. He would tell Putin, we don't like what you're doing in Ukraine, but is there a way for you to save face? Kennedy tried to put himself in the shoes of his opponent. I'm not so sure we do that very well today. So in that, I think he would try and handle the Russians with the respect and the agility with which he had handled Khrushchev in 1963.
That was June 10th.
June 10th.
With the speech at American University. On June 11th comes, as you mentioned, the speech about civil rights. And explain how President Kennedy framed civil rights less as a legal question than one of conscience.
Well, you were saying earlier, was there an epiphany on peace? Well, actually, there was probably an epiphany on civil rights. And that came in the month of May when, you may recall, Paul, Birmingham had exploded. And the images from Birmingham were shocking to President Kennedy. Those images were high-pressure hoses and German shepherd dogs applied to black protesters in the streets of Birmingham who had been marching for the month of May. Dr. King had gone to Birmingham. He was thrown in jail. He writes from that jail, famously, that letter from a Birmingham jail. Kennedy saw those images. He had been slow on civil rights. He was Jack Kennedy, a white Irishman from Boston and Brookline and Bronxville and the all-white Navy and the all-white Congress. He didn't know black people. He didn't, unlike Lyndon Johnson or Harry Truman or Eisenhower, he had not come from a part of the country where he would have rubbed shoulders with them. He was an aristocrat from Boston. And yet, when he sees those photographs and pictures, they are deeply troubling to him. They're also embarrassing to him because he is talking about freedom around the world and he's saying we're not practicing it at home. So they had made the decision by early June that there was going to be a Civil Rights Act. The question was, when would they announce it? And the Kennedys were never one to waste a crisis. And when George Wallace stood at the door on June the 11th, my goodness, the Kennedys said, we have a crisis. And this was a time, against the advice of all his advisors, that he decided to go on TV that night. As I say, the speech was hastily written, and it was incomplete, and he improvises at the 11-minute mark. But he is committed that night to telling Americans why George Wallace was wrong and why they had to see black Americans differently in the way the day before he had asked them to see Russians differently. He's humanizing both. And he's using language in that civil rights speech, which is for the ages. In fact, he says, you know, this kind of humanity is as old as the scriptures and as clear as the American Constitution. And he talks in both speeches about morality and humanity. And this was a JFK that people, you know, he was famously the aloof Irishman from Boston, you know, an icon and a celebrity in America. People loved John F. Kennedy, but he wasn't considered empathetic. He wasn't considered that type of leader. Well, in this speech, which again, you know, listeners can watch, you'll see a Kennedy who, he's seated at his desk in the Oval Office. It's in black and white, but you see a president who is seized by the office, and on both days, he tries to use the bully pulpit, the power of the presidency, to educate people. That's what he thinks the president should be for. And it's in these 2 days that we see the kind of president, had he lived, that he might have become, because he sees the office as something from which he can move people. And that's not everybody does in that office. You could say President Obama's not using the office rhetorically the way John F. Kennedy was, and Barack Obama has those gifts, but he's not as likely to talk about race and other issues in the same way as John Kennedy did.
We're down to about 10 seconds, but the relevance of Kennedy and his appeal to white America remains jarringly relevant today. The fires of frustration for many African Americans are still burning, aren't they?
They absolutely are, and that's why there's this eerie resonance between the events both on race and the Russians from 1963 to today. Today, John F. Kennedy would say, my God, we still have part of our population that doesn't feel comfortable in the face of white power.
Andrew, I need to jump in. I'm sorry, I need to jump in because we're out of time, but it's been a fascinating conversation. Andrew Cohen is author of 2 Days in June, John F. Kennedy and the 48 Hours That Made History. Andrew, thank you so much for joining us.
A great pleasure. Thanks for having me.
And that's Essential Pittsburgh for today. So long for now.